Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, or the Lord of hosts. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day or toward a day of slaughter. That's a pretty heavy load to carry, isn't it? That's a pretty strong blast. James 5, 1 through 5, as we continue our series of messages in the book of James, the theme of James, worldliness versus godliness. And when we get down to money, we get right down to where we live. We get down to the bone, brother. We get down to the secret places in our lives. We get down to where it hurts. And James minces no words. I am convinced that the greatest danger in our society is not communism. I'm convinced that it's a combination of the craze for the good, easy, luxurious life. James talks about the combination of that and alcoholism. I'm more worried about those two things, or the combination of them, than I am about communism as such. If the communists took over tomorrow, most of the nation wouldn't know the difference. They'd be too drunk. And those who weren't drunk would probably stand up and say, well, it's all right with me. It doesn't matter what kind of system we have, as long as I don't have to miss as the world turns and you don't take my boat away from me. Now, in the context of James, worldliness versus godliness, we have this thing of the danger of this attitude, this philosophy of life. Now, I don't think James is writing, as we analyze the text, he's not writing particularly to or against rich Christians, or particularly to or against rich non-Christians. He's talking about this kind of life, the kind of thing it is, and the danger of it. He's speaking of it as a principle. That is, he's saying this is the kind of thing, this is the kind of life, this is the kind of approach, this is the kind of philosophy, this is the kind of lifestyle that carries with it these dangers. And so he says to those who are rich, he said, you ought to weep and howl for your miseries. Quite strong language, I think we would agree. Now, this is appropriate for us because in America, our standard of living permits ease more than other folk have had in the past. It doesn't mean that wealth is inherently causes this, but I think the fact that we have ease breeds the desire for more ease. I was never really impressed with this until about 1964 when Linda and I were in Jamaica for 2 weeks and went up for a few nights into the mountains to preach at a little church. And it was a church that you could have put in the area in the front of our building between the pews and the platform and not used up all of it. It had a dirt floor and wood benches. I mean wood, I mean plank benches. And we had some beautiful folk there, though. And I noticed that those folks who absolutely had nothing. There was a hurricane warning. The hurricane was supposed to hit the island the next day. It didn't, but it veered at the last minute, for which my wife was grateful. It didn't bother me. But there was a hurricane coming, and didn't bother those folks a bit, because if the hurricane came and blew away all that they had, about 35 or 40 cents would have replaced most of it. Now, and I noticed in their lives that there was a quality in them that mine didn't have. A lot of it was because I was more tied up with things than they were, simply because I had more things than they had. Now, it's appropriate for us to take seriously James 5, 1 through 5, because our standard of living permits us a degree of luxury and ease, even though we might not admit it. 1 Corinthians 10, 7, we have a very clear description of our society, of our day. It's not particularly ours, but it certainly is ours. It's not ours exclusively, but it does describe the lifestyle of 20th century America. 1 Corinthians 10, 7, he reads, and do not be idolaters. Interesting word for those who follow this kind of life. And do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. The nightclub ethic, the nightclub society, They sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. The modern concept of the good life is seen as a healthy young. I don't know why young is good. You know, I used to think that young was good, but I'm beginning to change my mind. I don't know why that is. But, you know, I look back, I think that the ideal years are 22 to 23, and you can, and you, if you smoke the right cigar and drink the right booze and have a tan, use the right deodorant and mouthwash, have the right hairspray, and you're one of the lively people in a dune buggy, that's the good life. And a Pepsi belongs, as well as a few other things. And, you know, I look back in 20, 25, I wouldn't be that young and stupid again for anything in the world. Well, anyway, Lewis McNeese, in a little poem called The Barroom Matins, writes this: popcorn, peanuts, clams, and gum, we whose kingdom has not come, have mouths like men, but still are dumb. We only deal in here and now, as circumstances may allow, and the sponsored program tells us how. You see, we sit down to eat and drink, and we rise up to play. And in James 5, we have not so much a list of particulars as we have an attitude, a quality, and a direction of life. An attitude, a quality, and a direction of life. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are come upon you. And have you ever noticed that the things that used to seem like luxuries have become necessities? And I've noticed this, that when somebody else had them or has them, they're luxuries, but when I have them, they're necessities. You ever notice that? And so we do not have a list of particulars. You know, what is a luxury, a thing of ease and wanton pleasure, as James calls it for one man, might not be for another man. And so I think it would be out of line for us to draw up a list of particulars and say, now these things, if you have or do these things, this constitutes a life of ease and luxury as opposed to Christian discipline and discipleship, and this one doesn't. But I do think, on the other hand, that we ought to not rationalize away James 5, 1 through 5. And I think we ought to, the beginning place is that we all ought to declare ourselves guilty going in. I think we'll have a lot easier time with James 5, 1 through 5. If we get off our high horse and say, yes, I admit that I have more than I need. I like my ease and luxury. I like escapism. I like the good life as our society, our culture, our time, the spirit of our age defines the good life. And so having admitted our guilt, we, I think, are going to be in a better shape as we deal with James 5, 1 through 5. Now, a brief analysis of the text would go like this. He says, now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are come upon you. Isn't this interesting? That he's calling upon those who seem to have everything going for them, have the good life. He's saying you ought to weep and howl, wail, put on sackcloth and ashes. And I dare say that if in America we could draw back the veil of the veneer, which is what we call, our country calls the good life, and see in the background of this philosophy, this attitude of life, the impending judgments of God, I've got a pretty good idea there'd be some weeping and wailing going on today. It seems a paradox. It's a very startling, emphatic teaching of James to say to a man who is living a life of ease and luxury and splendor, the bills are paid, he's got everything he wants and needs, and he says to him, howl and weep for your miseries. What are those miseries? The miseries of the imminent judgments of God. Then verses 2 and the first part of 3, he points out some of the basic error. Your riches have rotted and decayed, rusted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. In what way would, in judgment, the rust on their money, the corrosion on their money, and their moth-eaten garments be a witness against them in judgment? Well, you see, it's because they had so much more than they needed. There was an over-concern for getting more than needed, an over-concern for keeping more than was needed. You see, in those days when money was stored, money was not as fine as alloys in our money. Even our money, if you lay it up long enough, it will tarnish. And he said, you've had so much, you spent so much concern getting more than you needed, and so much concern keeping more than you needed that you laid it up and it rusted. People were going hungry and your money was rusting. The Lord's work was going begging and your money was rusting. Missionaries were sacrificing in some places and your money was rusting. The Lord's work was not being done. And this rust, the fact that you didn't need it, will rise up and meet you in judgment. And so with garments. In those days, a change of garments was a very expensive thing. Clothing was not freely available as it is now. And a man who would have so many clothes that he would keep them stored back until the moths would eat them was almost unheard of. In other words, moth-eaten clothes were a sign of wealth because most the average person wore his out. He wore them out before the moths got to them. So the picture is a man who has so many clothes that he stored them back, and before he could get time to wear them out, the moths got them. He said, "These moths are going to meet you at judgment." Because they will testify that you had an over-concern for getting more than you needed and an over-concern for keeping more than we need. Now that's, as I said, we do not want to emasculate our text. We do not want to say, well, yes, but that doesn't mean me. I think it means us. I think that's exactly what it means. We have an over-concern, all of us. If you think you haven't, well, you meet me after church and I'll pray with you. We all have an over-concern for getting what we need and more than we need. And what we think we need is really a far cry from what we really need, isn't it? An over-concern for keeping more than we need. And look at it, and then in the last part of 3, well, in verse 4, we have this over-concern for keeping. "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. You won't even pay those to whom you owe just debts." The law of Moses required that a man, if he hired another man to work for him, that he had to pay him at the end of each day. And he said, "You've withheld and you haven't paid, and those who've done your harvesting, their outcries because of your all-consuming desire to keep what you have." This thing of get and keep, this all-consuming desire which has led you to hold back the just wages of those who have worked for you, then their cries are going up to the Lord. They're being heard by the Lord of hosts, and he's going to remember. So you have in verses 2 and the first part of 3 and verse 4 a clear statement of this over-concern for getting, over-concern for keeping. And then in verse 3 we have a very interesting statement. He says, "It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure." Let me read that again. He seems to be saying, don't you know what's going on? Don't you know when it is? It's in the last days that you stored up your treasure. So what? What does that mean? Why should it be such an astounding thing that any man, any Christian, would have this over-concern for getting and over-concern for keeping in the last days? We read in 1 Peter 3, verses 10 through 13, that these are the last days, and the day of the Lord will come, in the which the heavens and the earth will melt with the fervent heat, the earth and the things in it will be burned up. He says, seeing then that all these things, everything that we think is so important, all these things will be destroyed, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy living and conversation, in manner of life? What kind of people ought we to be, seeing that all these things are going to be burned up? And the utter absurdity of it is pointed out by James when he says, it's in the last days that you're doing this. My, how committed we are to that which we cannot keep, and how we neglect that which we cannot lose. And a man is no fool if he gives up that which he cannot keep in order to gain that which he cannot lose. It's in the last days. Listen, it's too late. Christian, listen, this is hard on all of us, but we might as well admit that it's too late. Too late to be selfish. It's too late to have our lives tied up with mammon. It's too late to live our lives with the philosophy of get and keep. And then he points out this, he illustrates this philosophy of life, where it leads. You have lived luxuriously on the earth, verse 5, led a life of wanton pleasure. You fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. Now, this verse here, the last part of verse 5, I would put along with some of the clinical, scathing language of the prophets. James in the spirit of Isaiah, in the spirit of Ezekiel, as they absolutely in the terms which are, which if there are some statements in the Old Testament which are so scathing and so clinical and so direct and so plain you hesitate to read them in a public worship service. And James in this spirit says, you know what you're doing? It's like fattening up an old hog for market. Now you farmers understand this. You know, you go out and you poke him and you pin him up and feed him, you corn feed him the last few weeks, get him just right. You say, boy, you know, he's just ready for slaughter. And he says, this is what you've done to your own hearts and lives. You fatten yourself up for the day of judgment. That's quite a, as I said, it's a graphic picture of a man stuffing himself, saying, well, you know, I'm going to hell. I'm going to go on and do it right. I'm going to meet God in judgment, and I'll just keep on adding sin to sin. I'll keep on gaining and getting and getting and keeping and keeping and keeping, because someday I'm going to meet God. He's going to take it all away from me. Now, in the last part of this message, let's consider why. What's really wrong with the good life? What our world calls the good life. Listen, I'm pointing out this morning that in Christ you have the good life. Luke 12, verses 15 and following, he said, don't you know that a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things which he possesses? And he told the famous parable of the rich fool, about a man who had all that he needed, and he finally had so much he didn't have any place to put. He said, this I will do. I will tear down my barns and build greater. And then I will say to my soul, Saul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. God said to him, fool, this night your soul is going to be required of you. Then who shall these things be which you have provided? In case you all missed that, let me give you the modern paraphrase of it. It's a man who had a good job with periodic raises, two cars, and a nice house in the suburbs. And the problem was there was no room for his boat or backyard pool. So he decided the way to remedy the problem was to sell his house in the suburbs and buy a bigger place in the country. There he would have room for everything, plus some additional things he wanted. And after moving into his new house, he decided he had made it, and he was going to celebrate, and he planned a big party. But while cleaning the new pool, he suffered a heart attack and died. I thought I'd pull that in case you missed Luke's. Now, you see, we're guilty. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of the thing that he possesses, and in the name of God in the last days, we ought to quit living like it does. In the last days is no time to live as if the abundance that a man's life, the quality of a man's life, the essence of a man's life consists in the abundance of what he possesses. Very quickly, there are four things that are wrong with what our world calls the life of ease and luxury, the life of get and keep, the life of enjoy. First of all, it's unthinkable in the last days because we have no rights of private ownership. This is the biggest myth. This is the biggest thing one of the biggest things that we Christians have to get over, the idea that everything belongs to us. The system of capitalism has taught us this, and don't get me wrong, I think a system of capitalism, economically speaking, is better than communism, but capitalism is not the monetary, the economic doctrine of the kingdom of God. The communist says everything belongs to everybody, which adds up to nothing belonging to anybody. The capitalist says that everything belongs to the individual, but God says everything belongs to him. Did you ever read 1 Corinthians 6:20 where it says, you are not your own. You have been bought with a price. And if I do not own myself, how in the world can I have in my kingdom material things? It belongs to God. And I get tired of hearing this thing, the tithe belongs to God. News for you, it all belongs to God. It's all his. The second thing that's wrong with what our world calls the good life is that spirituality, because of the nature of things, is found in the discipline of godliness, not the wantonness of worldliness. And this is the main thrust of much of the book of James, that true spirituality cannot be achieved by the life of ease and luxury and get and keep. That is not the road to spirituality. True spirituality is found in the discipline of godliness. And it's no accident that the word disciple has in it the word discipline. Third reason why the good life is wrong, as our world defines the good life, is that happiness is found in giving, not getting. What makes a life good? When does a life become good? Let me tell you, a life is good when it's happy, no matter what you have or don't have. And the only saying of Jesus that's recorded in the scriptures, but not in the gospel narratives, is quoted in Acts 20:35. Paul says, as Jesus said, not recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, it's more blessed, you're happier giving than receiving. And listen, the Christian, if he's in Christ, must have done with the philosophy of get and keep. Our lives are built on give, because if we're disciples of Jesus, we can do little else but give, because he gave his all. The last reason I would give is that peace is found in the long view, not the short view of things. And we're back to where we started in James. He seems to pull back the veil, pull back this facade of splendor and ease and luxury, and point to things as they are. He says to the rich, howl and weep for the miseries that are coming upon you. True peace is found in the long view, not the short view. We've got to see things as they are. We get caught up in the short view of life. We think that happiness is just one more thing. Happiness is another $1,000 in the bank. Happiness is a little more security. Happiness is a little bigger insurance policy. These things in and of themselves must be disciplined by what God says. Oh, listen. Is your life built on get and keep, on give? Listen, get and keep is a dead-end road. It leads to nowhere. Because the man whose life is built upon get and keep never gets enough and is never able to keep it all. But I'm going to tell you, there's joy in giving. Jesus had it right. Listen, Jesus made us. Did you ever read Hebrews 1 and John 1? He made us. Through him he made the worlds. That's Jesus. And if he made us, he ought to know what makes us happy. And he said, you're going to be happy, get in the give business. And get out of the get business. Well, these are last days, and the good life is found in giving and growing and learning and praying and serving. It's the last days. And I think this is one of the most interesting statements in the book of James. It's the last days that you've stored up your treasure. And treasure is not made to be stored up in the last days. It's made to be given and used and dedicated to God by the very nature of the thing. Be strong. We are not here to play, to dream, to drift,